Welcome to Upstart Crow, a part of Watershed Lit Radio. Join us as we explore books and culture through engaging conversations with writers, historians, and creatives, offering unique insights into the literary arts and beyond. Hosted by Ken Budd, Jennifer DeSano, and William Miller. Now, here's the show.
Welcome, podcast listeners, to another episode of Upstart Crow. I'm William Miller, your host, and my guest today is Andy Shalal, author of the memoir, A Seat at the Table, because he's the founder of the Busboys and Poets restaurants, bookstores, and activist gathering places in the D.C. region. Welcome, Andy.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, like so many people, I suspect, been in your restaurants a great deal, bought books at your place, did a podcast about an author and a book that I didn't even know existed until I went into one of your stores and saw the book. It was a great discovery. I think of you as an activist and a social conscience, if you will. Underneath that, though, beats the heart of a foodie. I didn't know this until I read the book, Andy. You're a foodie.
Well, I sort of reject that a little bit, that kind of term, because I feel like foodies are all about focusing on the food. And I am more a people person. Food is basically a way to bring people together to the table. It's like I always say, you know, people remember experiences much more than they remember the actual food. So like everybody remembers like the greatest meal they ever had. And oftentimes it's about the people you're with, the environment you're in, the way it was served. Of course, the food has to be good, but that's not always what makes a meal great, because sometimes it's about the experience you have that comes with the food that you're served.
You're absolutely right. And I totally agree. Sort of expected you'd say something like that, just, you know, because I mean, I read the book, but like you said, the food has to be good. You could be sitting there with the person you love the most in the whole wide world. And if the service isn't good and the food isn't good, it's going to spoil the evening.
Yeah. I've actually heard one time, I think somebody did some research on this and they said that 80% of conversations that happen at the table in a dining room are about the restaurant and the food that the people are eating. So it fills a lot of spaces, right? Especially if you're meeting somebody for the first time, or if you're not, you know, as familiar with the person, or you're there just to go out to dinner and not really for a purpose other than that, you start talking about the food a lot. So yes, it can, you know, a bad meal or bad service can definitely turn things around. And, you know, people put so much effort and energy into going out. And sometimes, you know, we go out to eat, to meet a new person, to go out on a date, to celebrate an occasion, to propose to somebody, to end the relationship with somebody. I mean, there's so many reasons. And sometimes there's so much emphasis put on that. Like we've had people come and bring an engagement ring and have us put it into a drink so that we can bring it out to the table. And if somebody loses that ring, if somebody misplaces it, if somebody doesn't do it in the right timing, if somebody kind of spoils the experience, that ruins a person's life. Like it could be like, oh my God, we're on the wrong footing. How am I going to marry this person and have a good life with them? So I think there's so much, you know, we've had people come and plan to propose on open mic and, you know, they come days before, then they come that day, then they sort of work with us to see when they're going to enter and what they're going to be eating at the moment when they come in and so on. All that has to be orchestrated in such a way that makes them feel really good. And if you screw it up, you can really, you know, create bad karma for people and they get very, very upset. So a lot of stuff happens in restaurants.
You're saying so much just in talking about this, just that you're aware that this goes on within your business says so much about you.
Well, I think, you know, I've always learned the power of convening, the power of food. You know, many of us belong to boards and organizations, someone like that. My favorite ones are the ones that serve like a meal when they meet with you. You know, there are board meetings where you walk in and don't even get a glass of water. And, you know, you just can't wait to leave the board meeting. And all you're thinking about is like, where's my coffee? Where's my service? Where's my food? Where's my cookie? You know, something. So I think food is, everybody eats. Like it transcends politics, race, ethnicities, culture, whatever it is, everybody eats. We all have rituals around that. So I wanted to make sure that I use that opportunity, really, of bringing people together to advance, you know, social justice and other agendas that I think a lot of people want to see happen in the world.
Let's go back. You started working in a restaurant, helping your father, your brother, and your sister when you were 13. You all had immigrated from Iraq when you were 11, so a couple of years prior to that. What were you like as a kid in Iraq? What was your childhood? This isn't covered in the book, but it was something I wanted to ask you, if you don't mind. What was your childhood in Iraq like?
Well, we lived in Iraq for part of the time, but we also lived in Morocco. My father was a diplomat, and he was stationed in Morocco for like 3 years. So out of the 11 years, 3 years were spent in Morocco, and we were in American boarding schools. So I think even though I did not speak English when I came to the United States, I had some formative years where I heard English regularly and was able to, you know, get used to the sound of the language. But in Iraq, I mean, we lived in a modest home in a neighborhood in Baghdad. Family was a lot. Family was the focus for our entertainment, for our experience, for going out and so on. And my uncles and, of course, my cousins and others all lived within, you know, 10 minutes, 15 minutes of each other. So we were always in and out of each other's homes. And our family's home was never, like, and I mean that literally, empty. It always had people coming in and out. People come unannounced. You know, they come knocking on the door, and, you know, all of a sudden you've got a meal. My mother was a real pro at putting together a meal within 30 minutes for a group of 30 people. She would have stuff frozen sometimes just to kind of have it as backup, you know, and so you'd have some kebabs and some chicken, whatever, frozen, and somebody shows up, and all of a sudden more people show up, and pretty soon that stuff comes out, gets thrown in the oven, rice is cooked, bread is put together, and suddenly you've got this feast going on in moments. So this was something that was always in my mind, you know, and Iraq is, especially during the summertime, is very hot, you know, and so in the afternoons or late afternoon when the sun sets, it gets a little bit cooler. And the way that people, this is back, of course, in the 60s, the way people deal with that heat is they're living outside the house, and we had all the furniture be moved outside in the yard. The trees would be sprayed with water, creating this sort of breeze that's a little cooler. We spend the entire evening outside, you know. We had a big chicken coop where we, you know, we collected eggs from it. And that was my favorite thing, to wake up in the morning and go get the eggs from the chickens. Just a lot of activities that were happening all the time. We had date trees that we used to climb and get dates. You know, there are 500 varieties of dates in Iraq, and our backyard had probably 10 varieties. And, you know, plum trees and, you know, other fruit trees that were there. You know, it was a very good place for a child to grow, because it really was a village, and people, like, you'd be out in the street walking, and, you know, everybody knew everybody. And of course, then coming then to the United States, you're like confronted with this very different reality. First of all, you don't know anybody here. And then, you know, your friends are not here, and you're different than everybody else. So you don't get that connection quickly. You don't speak the language. So that created lots of challenges, of course, but you know, challenges always, I think, opportunities to grow in a different way. And I think it certainly set us on a trajectory that I think brought us here today.
And in, maybe this is a good telling point. Andy is not your official first name.
No, it's not, which is really funny. And I've been trying to go back to my original name, Enes, because I like the name Enes, but it never stuck. People like immediately gravitate to Andy. And so I was like, after a while, it was like, I've got businesses, people know me on the business world, so on as Andy. And it'd be just so confusing to start calling myself Enes again and have people, let's say, woo, what, you know, and the pronunciation of that name can go every which way. And so I kind of just said, okay, let's just stick with Andy and get away with it.
Well, in the book, you talk about how the school kids that you were suddenly enrolled what they did with Enes
exactly.
Your name. Yes. And we'll leave it to our listeners to fill in the imagination there. And it's not far.
Just replace one vowel with another vowel, and you've got, you know, you can go there.
Your father came over as a diplomat working for the Arab League and then was asked to come back after a couple of years, and you all didn't want to go back. So he bought a pizza restaurant.
Right. Of course. What else
Normal.
Do you do?
What else do you do? Exactly.
That was certainly accidental because my father knew nothing of restaurants. We barely went out to eat. He was a professor at University of Baghdad teaching literature. And, you know, he did his PhD in Omar Khayyam, which is like the poet, the Sufi poet. So he had nothing to do with restaurants, knew nothing about business. He was not a businessman in any way, shape, or form. And it was, you know, he was going to get a job at a university in Salt Lake City, Utah State. And we were getting ready to move. I mean, he was committed to it. We packed, we sold a lot of stuff. My mother sold a whole bunch of stuff, thinking we're going to need some startup money to be able to go there. And last minute, like literally, we were packed, ready to go. And I think 3 or 4 days before then, a friend of his approached him and he said, look, I have this restaurant. I'm having some health issues. I need to sell it. And I think you should buy it. And my father, of course, thought the guy was crazy. What am I don't know. I know nothing about restaurants. And he said, I'll teach you everything. It's easy. The staff is already there. And so, sure enough, my father went to try it out. He loved the sound of the register, nonstop ringing. And he said, you know, maybe this is what I need to do. And the guy says, yeah, if you're in America, you should definitely go into business. America is not for working. You know, create a business. Don't work for anybody else. And I think my father would have been a terrible employee anyway. So he went ahead and emptied his savings account, basically, and bought this restaurant. And of course, as immigrant children, we became, you know, de facto slave labor. And we ended up working there. And it was fun, actually. You know, I really enjoyed it. And it gave us a lot of credibility with our schoolmates, because they can get free French fries and free Cokes, you know, just by showing up. And that was kind of cool to be able to be in a position where you can have, you know, friends come up to you and you can like be behind the counter as the boss, so to speak, at age 13.
And you write in the book that you would be working there on a Sunday and imagine if this place were yours, what you would be doing. So even then, your future self is there in your imagination.
You're absolutely right, Bill. I think for me, I secretly enjoyed serving. And I didn't want to tell my father that because he would be really disappointed. He didn't want us to serve. He saw the restaurant as just a way to make a living here. And he saw better for his kids. He did not want us to be serving people. He wanted us to be served by people. He wanted us to have, you know, a job and in government or something like that, where you have a suit and you have a desk and you have a, you know, regular hours and you have a secretary and you have things, you know, all the trappings that people imagine what a good life looks like.
In fact, your parents wanted you to go to medical school and be a doctor.
Absolutely. Yeah. They wanted us to be a doctor.
You're a med school dropout.
That sounds awful. But yeah, I was not interested at all. And I had a very rough relationship with my parents also. I was one of those kids that was just a nightmare. You know, everything they said, I was like opposite, you know, and was trying to find myself and didn't want them in the way of that. And it became a challenge to be a parent, certainly to a kid like me, and for me to be, you know, a kid for parents like that, because their expectations were so unrealistic, in my opinion. They kind of like, once we moved here, they put like a lockdown on our social life. We couldn't go out. We could not do things. You know, it was very limited opportunities to do anything outside the house other than work. And I wanted to have fun. I wanted to rebel. I wanted to do things. I wanted to go out, smoke pot, whatever it is that you did. And there was not an opportunity for that. So I kind of like just kind of said, screw this. I'm not going to be a part of this kind of setup. So I rebelled.
You were the middle child, right?
I was the middle child.
And you showed it in some ways.
I know, yeah. My brother was also kind of a naughty kid, but he was a little bit more accepting of the punishment that came with that. And I would be like defiant. You can't punish me. You have no right to punish me. Don't touch me. You know, like
But your parents also set some high goals for you. I mean, you speak of that. For some reason, they put you 2 years ahead when they brought you to the U.S.
Yeah, which was really a terrible mistake. I would never do that to a child. I think, you know, now, in fact, I think a lot of parents are realizing that putting your kid ahead like that is not healthy emotionally for the child, and they're holding kids back. In fact, I think they've just initiated a law here in DC. You can't hold your kid back more than like a year or something like that. But they thought by speeding things up, I would have a head start on life, so to speak, you know? And that doesn't make sense. You know, life is just what it is, you know? And I think they also wanted me and my brother to be kind of in the same space because they thought we would be like protecting one another and be together like that, which I can understand. So yeah, they moved me up a year when we first got here. And then once I got here, I was able to do okay, you know, academically. So they moved me up another year. And I got out of high school at 15, started college at 15. And it was like not the best situation to be in because you're 15 with 18-year-olds and 19-year-olds, you know, in college. And you're not going to get a date with an 18-year-old if you're 15. You're just not. So it became really difficult. I had to lie about my age like for the first couple of years, of course, in college. I didn't look really 15, so it wasn't that hard, but still, my brain was 15 for sure, or even 14 maybe.
Well, and you got a short-lived first marriage out of that.
I did indeed. I had a severe stuttering problem that really sort of got in the way of my social life, so to speak. And I ended up marrying a woman who was also in university. She was a speech therapist. She was working to get her degree in speech therapy. And she was the one that introduced me to speech therapy, something I'd never heard of before or never even considered. But it was eye-opening for me to be in a situation where you're getting like therapy for this infliction, and really helped me to seek more therapy. And, you know, I'm a real believer in therapy when it's focused, you know, on a specific issue. Some people just go to therapy professionally just to go to therapy. And sometimes that really doesn't go anywhere. You end up just going in circles with your own self. But I think speech therapy and therapy like that, I think is very, very effective, very useful. So I was grateful that she was able to introduce me to this and was able to sort of take it on and resolve my speech therapy and my speech problem just with therapy, which I think is remarkable that you can do that. It didn't take medication. It didn't take anything. It was just like conversations that pulled me out of that, which I thought, wow, this is pretty cool.
Backing up just a little bit in terms of your youth, you in school, you were abnormal. I remember in the book, you talk about a girl coming up to you and asking if you were high yellow. And this was at a time when immigrants were not as numerous, perhaps. This is the late 60s, early 70s, and particularly Arab immigrants were not as numerous. Talk about that for a few moments, if you will. Basically, it's a form of racism, right? Your experience?
I mean, yes, of course. I was introduced to race very early on. It's something I had not been aware of in Iraq. Race was not something you talk about, or it's not even a, I don't even know what the word for race is in Arabic. You know what I mean? It's one of those things that you just don't see. And so coming to America is very, very real and very present. And I looked, you know, I looked ambiguous. You know, people couldn't tell whether I was black or white or whatever. And it created a whole set of challenges because you had to pick when you're filling out a form, when you're, you know, speaking to somebody or something, you had to pick whether you're white, black. And back then there was just white, black, and other. There wasn't other categories as they are today. And it was embarrassing sometimes because you leave it blank. You put white, they look at you like, you don't look white. Why are you putting white? And if you're black, they look at you, you're not black. Why are you putting black? And so you put other, and other is just feels so awkward. And for a kid that's 11 years old, they don't want to be the other. They want to belong to some group. And other was just not a group that anybody wanted to belong to. And so you ended up having to choose sides. And I wasn't accepted in either group. So it wasn't my choice to choose sides. I just wasn't allowed to choose sides per se. And so it became really difficult to navigate the social constructs within the school environment. And I was lucky to have a very understanding teacher who was my art teacher, who was able to actually recognize sort of my isolation, so to speak, and really took me in to spend, especially lunchtime, because lunchtime is where you make those choices, right? To bring me into the class and be able to do art while I'm having lunch. And I'm an artist, so I enjoyed art. That was like something that came to me naturally. Then, of course, years later, I was able to work on therapy and be able to overcome the speech impediment and continue to find myself in a different way, you know?
So basically, the two strands of your life, if you will, the immigrant Arab background and the restaurant business come together as you're moving into your young adult years. And we associate you with Busboys, but that wasn't the first restaurant you opened. I think it was called Skewers that you opened on your own.
Well, the first restaurant I opened in DC was called Skewers. Right. But of course, I worked in restaurants. After I left my medical studies, I wanted to figure out something to do. And I knew my parents would not be happy with that decision. So I had to kind of figure out a way to make a living, so to speak, at that young age. And I started waiting tables because waiting tables, gave you instant cash in your pocket and you got a meal. So there was no chance of going hungry if you work in a restaurant. And so I ended up just getting into the restaurant business, well, early on, of course, with my father, but then I left it when we went to college. And then I came back to it because it was just a fallback for me at that moment, never imagining that I would make it a career, really never imagining that I would end up, you know, being in the restaurant business, so to speak. It was just a placeholder for the time being, because it gave me the freedom to be able to think of other things that I need to do. It gave me the freedom to be able to figure out where I'm going with my life and so on. So here I am working in restaurants, loving the hell out of it, making decent money for, you know, for what I was expecting. And, you know, immediately get tapped by the management. Oh, you're too good at this. Why don't you become a manager? You know, and so slowly you get pulled into management. And once you pulled into management, you start seeing the ins and outs of it, and then becomes like, okay, I can do this. And then you start learning about, you know, how would you do it better? How would you change things? And, you know, it's not your place, so you can't really make those changes necessarily. So you think, okay, I'm going to learn everything I can and then go on and take all my learning, take all my experiences, positive and negative, whatever, and put them together to create my own space. And I knew I could do that because I work hard. I think I can figure things out fairly quickly. And I just had the drive, you know, I wanted something more. And I kept looking for a way to try to figure out, I wasn't thinking of owning my own place at that time. I thought I would work for a large company, maybe the restaurant industry, that would allow me to grow and be able to continue to do on an upward trajectory and a career path. And then by different circumstances, I had the opportunity to actually go back and open up a small place. And my first place I ever opened was called Little Italy, which was a small little Italian restaurant because I knew how to cook Italian food really well. Italian food is fairly easy to cook, but you just have to use really good ingredients and season it just right. You know, so it's not a lot of, it doesn't require a lot of artistry. It just requires a lot of care, really, more than anything else. And I knew how to do that. So I created really good, sauces and really good dishes and opened it up on a shoestring, like literally very little money, and ended up to be a huge hit. And I thought, okay, I know how to do this. And I kept using that initial knowledge and experience and flaws and faults and successes to create more and more of a opportunity for a much larger space. And, you know, I mean, Busboys and Poets is not an easy operation. It's not an operation you would open out of the gate. So it really makes it very, very, it took a lot of work to get to Busboys and Poets. It's not like I woke up one day and said, I'm going to do Busboys and Poets.
You spoke about that you had perhaps imagined yourself working for a large company. And in fact, you were at the Shoreham, and envisioned yourself as a longer-term employee, but you got passed over for a promotion. And you didn't accuse anybody of racism, But I suspect, based on who got that job that you wanted, there was a little racism going on there.
Yeah, I did. I mean, I don't know whether it was or not, but I suspected that it was. I think I felt that I was really qualified for the job. I worked really, really hard. I was their top employee for months. I was only there about 2 years. But I really worked hard. I mean, I had the experience, and there was no reason why I wouldn't be the one to be selected. But they brought somebody from outside who ended up to be not as good as they had, I guess, anticipated. But by then, I was already kind of like thinking, this is not going to work out for me very well in this kind of industry. Because the industry was, I think it's changed a lot, but I think the industry back then certainly was very segregated. And, you know, top management was always European background. They would have occasionally they'd have a black person in there, like somebody that might be in upper management who was black, but that was rare. But having foreigners wasn't a common, I mean, non-European foreigners was not a common at all. So I didn't see myself in those positions. And I think I started to realize that I'm not going to succeed in this environment. I need to figure out my own spaces, my own environment.
So it was a bit of a glass ceiling in a sense.
I think so. And I think, you know, sometimes those things, you know, are awful when they happen. You feel so bad, but they're just such great opportunities that ended up to be, you know, as I look back at it, it's the best thing that ever happened to me. You know, I mean, back then it was like I was really upset and didn't like what happened. But if you take those moments and use them, sort of pivot as an opportunity to pivot, I think it makes the opportunity much more, or the moment much more of a growing opportunity rather than a hindrance.
It propels you off onto your own, and you find your own inner strength and capability.
Absolutely. So getting fired from a job is not the worst thing that could happen. Sometimes that's the best thing that could happen.
Or firing yourself from a job.
Firing yourself from a job, exactly.
So I sort of took us back a little bit. So you're working Little Italy, but you're moving toward other restaurants. And I don't think people who sort of have discovered you in the 20 years since you opened the Busboys understand that, you know, it wasn't your first. There was Mimi's, which was, that must have been a hoot to run. Talk about Mimi's for a second.
Yeah, I opened Mimi's. It was in an area, of course, the Dupont Circle. There had been a restaurant there in that neighborhood that was called Herb's, which was kind of the popular artsy restaurant where, you know, musicians and artists and all these people came out and hung out after a show or after the Kennedy Center or whatever they were doing in town. And it became this sort of buzzy place where you always can spot some star somewhere in there. And I thought, you know, and it went out of business or moved or something happened to it. And I thought, you know what? I miss that space and I miss the energy that comes with artists. I always love to be around artists because just so much fun and so much life comes through when artists are around in the room. And I thought, you know, I could create something like that. And it didn't have singing servers. It didn't have all of these things. But I thought, you know, that's one way to do it is to have artists that are workers also there. Because oftentimes, you know, people that are working on their craft, whether they're singers or performers or something, they're not getting paid a lot of money and they need to supplement their income. And usually they're waiters, you know, or working in the restaurant business because the restaurant business gives you flexibility, the ability to call out if you need to, if you have an audition or something like that. It worked out really well. So, you know, we put ads in the paper to hire people from musical theater departments in Catholic University and Howard University and other places. And we got lots and lots of applicants. It was great. It was easy to get people to want to do this. And they end up to be, you know, pretty good servers because they're also actors and part of serving is actually performing. And so it fits. And then the customers love it because their server is also their singer and their performer. And so that was really cool to have, you know, the server come and take care of you and then says, I'm going to break out in song in a minute. And they go to the stage and they're, of course, their tables are applauding them and really kind of encouraging them. They make, you know, a fairly good amount of money, you know, the servers because of that. And everybody's happy. And it was a lively, exciting place. It was hard to get a reservation.
So why'd you give that one up?
Well, it wasn't enough. I mean, for me, the entertainment part was fun and all that, but I really wanted to get into more the politics. For me, the politics was really where my heart was. It's what I really wanted to do. Again, all these elements were ways to bring people together. Once they're there, I didn't want to lose that opportunity, right? So what do you do with people once in the room? How do you start, you know, having deeper conversations? You know, 9/11 happened and really kind of set me in a whole different direction because I thought, wow, this is, it's so easy. So being an American is just such a fleeting thing that could be taken away just instantly because people think of you as a terrorist today, where yesterday you were the best friend, you know, and Arabs and Muslims especially were seen as othered again, you know. So I thought, you know what, we need to have spaces where people can come together and, you know, experience each other's humanity and go beyond just the surface stuff that we see sometimes in the news or in newspapers. So I started thinking in terms of what is my business strength, and that is restaurants, and how can I turn that into an enterprise and opportunity? And so that was kind of like, I call myself a social entrepreneur as because I think of social issues and how can I solve them through business, so to speak. And so I started thinking in terms of creating this place that I ended up calling Bus Boys and Poets that had all the elements that I thought were necessary, the ingredients that are necessary to create a petri dish, so to speak, of activism and civic engagement.
Even before Bus Boys, you had bookstores and you had some civic engagement spaces that were like smaller scale and you tried some stuff.
Yes, yes, indeed. And, you know, it was Luna. Cafe Luna, I opened up a place called Luna Books and Democracy Center. And that was a very cool space that brought together activists to have these deeper conversations in a restaurant environment, but it was small. It was up on the third floor of a townhouse. You had to really know about it to get there. You know, it was not as accessible and so on. So that had a lot of negative, you know, elements to it physically, the space. And I wanted a space that's much bigger that can actually gather because I understood the idea of gathering. That was really important. And gatherings need a larger group of people. And there's an energy that comes through with that. When you have a lot of people in the same space together, kind of cheering or whatever they're doing, it gives a sense of possibility that people may not see when they're in a smaller group. And so I wanted something bigger and something unabashedly progressive, something with large windows so people see from outside. So you're not hiding in a corner or going in the basement or going up on the third floor, but you're right there, storefront, you know, showing what's possible. And that was kind of the beginning started at Luna, but the idea then became much bigger at Bus Boys and Poets.
It is rooted in who you are and the Iraqi background and a couple of key experiences. For example, you mentioned in the book, as you were going down to become a naturalized U.S. citizen, we invaded Grenada.
Yep, exactly.
So the country you were adopting and being adopted by was an invading country, attacking a much smaller country.
Yes. That was really a formative moment, I think, for me. And I didn't know where Grenada was at that time and feeling really awkward that I'm pledging allegiance to a flag that I had no idea where the country we were just invading is, let alone be affected by it in any way, shape, or form. So I'm in Alexandria, Virginia, getting ready to go to the courthouse to get sworn in. And the world is very normal. And I'm thinking, like, how is it that we can invade a country and things are so normal? There's no sign of it anywhere, you know, unless you're really paying attention to the news, you'd think nothing is happening. And, you know, I come from Iraq, of course, where when there's a war, you know, at least school was closed. You know what I mean? It was, you know, so that wasn't happening. And it was very strange. And I immediately, once I left the courthouse, I started researching and found out that Grenada actually is in the Caribbean. It's a small island that we invaded because it was getting too close to Cuba and communism. Of course, you know, the Monroe Doctrine, all this stuff played into this. It was a little disturbing, the fact that we were able to invade this country really under pretenses that were not true necessarily. Their prime minister, Maurice Bishop, was executed during the invasion. Hundreds of people were killed. And it was under the pretense of trying to rescue our medical school students who were going there to school in Grenada. So it was a very strange thing to happen, and it was made fun of. I mean, it was like made into a joke. And back then, Reagan was the president, and you know, Grenada's number one export is nutmeg. Believe it or not, imagine like you can actually have nutmeg as your main export. You know, but it was interesting that he was joking about it because it was around Thanksgiving and Christmas, and he said we needed nutmeg for eggnog, and I remember that line. You know, it was just so disgusting. I just couldn't believe it. But anyway, it was, I learned a lot about American imperialism and all this stuff that comes with it. It really kind of made me focus more on the politics and get more involved.
As tongue deaf as that remark was a worse moment for you when you were watching on television as American forces bombed your own country, where you knew people, you were seeing buildings that you recognized exploding when the bombs hit. You were worried about people that you knew. I don't know how you could take that and have a commentator who was saying this was the, quote, shock and awe, close quote, attack that we were promised.
Yes, the invasion of Iraq was also a very, very significant moment. It happened actually the day before my birthday, but it was, you know, basically I was getting ready to celebrate my birthday, and it was that shock and awe that we were told about, and having the commentators talk about it like it's, they're watching like fireworks on 4th of July. It was really pretty weird. And again, very sanitized and very orchestrated type of attack. And certainly the media was playing into that. You know, the media was basically the cheerleaders for what was happening. And it was really disturbing to watch and see how they're misinterpreting so much about what Iraq is, what Iraq is all about. I'm no fan of dictators, no fan of Saddam Hussein, but I thought there was a better way to be able to allow the people, Iraqi people, kind of decide their destiny and where they want to go, as opposed to us going there to save them. Well, Iraq is a mess right now. Even today, this is what, 20 some odd years later. Yeah, there are restaurants and there are places to go and so on. It's a little safer today than it was when the invasion was taking place. Mind you, it was very safe under Saddam Hussein as well. But now the corruption is off the charts. All the wealth of Iraq is being heisted outside. And it didn't set Iraq on a path to true democracy and true liberation and true, you know, growth for a country that is extremely wealthy and can easily become powerhouse in by any definition. So anyway, I think it's problematic what's happened to Iraq. And that sort of like also set me on the idea that we really, Americans are very, they have very little knowledge about anything outside of their space and their reality. And they need to learn and they need to have spaces where they can go and learn these things. And there was another reason to move forward on the idea of Busboys and Poets and create a space that has a bookstore, that has all kinds of books in there they can learn from, a place that has a stage where you can actually have panel discussions and authors and poets and people like that talk about specific issues of concern to all of us and have a space that people can connect with each other when they're coming in, a lounge kind of space so that we can interact with people that you normally wouldn't have a chance to interact with. So that was kind of the, again, another moment that propelled me toward opening Busboys and Poets.
In the book, you described after you had reached agreement to buy the space of the first Busboys on 14th Street, the building was just, you know, still taking shape and still, you know, but you went in and you sat there and you just sort of breathed in and out and you sort of got a feel for it. And I liked that moment, that sense of you becoming one with the building, if you will, and vice versa.
Yeah, spaces are really important. You know, I think we tend to underestimate the spaces. There are places that, like, you know, people say, like, the space is just jinxed. No matter what you put in there, it doesn't work, you know? And that's true. I mean, there is something to be said about that. And sometimes I think when we try to create a space in an area that historically had a whole different kind of concept of what that area was, I think it works against us. There's a reason why certain streets are main streets. There's a reason why certain areas grow and others don't. There's, you know, there's a lot going on that some of it is actual, you know, the geographical constraints that certain areas have, but others is really kind of, I think there's a spiritual element that comes with it. When you're creating spaces that had been historically of a certain type and suddenly you try to erase that, put concrete over it and create a neon image, it never really works. It always comes back to haunt you in so many ways. I think of Gaza today when they're talking about, you know, just covering up the dead bodies underneath the rubble and then putting high-rise buildings above it. I mean, just the thought of that in itself gives you that sort of, that sense of violation of humanity, really. And I want it to be in a space that fits the area that I'm in historically. That area historically had poetry. That area historically was predominantly Black. That area historically was an area of civil rights and, civil justice and civil upheaval. And I didn't want to erase that and create something totally new and modern. I wanted to actually bring that out and really kind of build on it and create more energy out of that, you know, kind of release the energy that's already there instead of trying to tamp it down.
You have certain political and social heroes. Obama was one. You, even though you had met him at a dinner and sat next to him, you weren't that impressed when you first met him, but you got wholeheartedly into his campaign, you and your wife both.
I think many people did, certainly. I think some of us are still disappointed by what he could have done. I think he was a little too timid in his approach. He had a mandate and he should have just ran with it. But I think, you know, I get it. Politicians are politicians. I remember when I wanted to have a peace ball, like an inaugural ball right after Obama was elected, because we were so electrified by this whole experience of getting this first Black man who seemed like really good to be elected as president. I remember Howard Zinn, the historian, telling me, he says, you know, I know you're excited about it, but you need to sort of temper your excitement because you will be disappointed. He's a politician. And so it was like, okay, a moment like, I get it. I see where you're going with this, but for now, I just want to celebrate. And so we did. We went out and celebrated. But sure enough, you know, Howard was right. I think a lot of good happened, but a lot of awful things also happened under Obama. And I'm really disappointed that Obama has not been more outspoken about what's happening today in the Middle East. He didn't even endorse Mamdani, which I thought was a silly thing. I mean,
well, didn't he in the end, right at the very end, didn't he? On the
eve, he didn't endorse him. He actually said, I'm here. If you need me, I'm available to be a sounding board and so on. But he never came out and said, I'm going to endorse this guy. And his endorsement is big. It's important. Not that Mamdani apparently needed him. But still, I think it says a lot about, it doesn't say anything about Mamdani. It says a lot about the people who refused to endorse him, Chuck Schumer and others who decided to sit on the sideline. It just doesn't look good, you know, when you call yourself true blue Democrat and then end up sort of holding back because this guy doesn't seem to fit your corporate idea of what a Democrat should be.
Well, he makes some people nervous. Howard Zinn is a person that you speak of in the book, and you cite him for a thing that I think is very interesting with regard to history. It's not what you put in, he said.
It's what you leave out. And that's really the truth, because a lot of times people think, oh, they're lying. Well, they may not be lying. They're just leaving out stuff. And so you can create a narrative by what you put in, what you leave out. And oftentimes history is told by what you leave out, because there's an endless amount of history. And you can take bits and pieces and create a narrative, or you can take these bits and pieces, create another narrative. And I think that's been the challenge that we have right now, right? There are the people who say, we shouldn't put stuff about slavery. We shouldn't put a lot of stuff about that. And even if we write stuff about slavery, we shouldn't write it like in such a bad way, because it wasn't all bad. It wasn't, you know, so all of that, you know, yes, they have an argument. And if you're watching Fox News all the time, that argument makes perfect sense at some level. But then, you know, where do you find reality? Where is truth really comes into it? And, you know, I think that's really been the biggest challenge we have as human beings living on this earth, is trying to figure out, you know, what makes sense for us as living beings on this planet. What could we agree on that can continue to allow us to all thrive and prosper? And that's a never-ending, you know, battle of words and ideas that needs to somehow get more focus into a more positive direction.
I think you're right. And I think it's, you know, quest. And I think the quest begins with all of us coming to understand the nature of knowledge being a constructed artifice.
Yeah, absolutely. And words matter. And, you know, how we say things and how we matter, that creates reality. You know, I mean, I think those who are in power oftentimes understand that and are able to use it for good or use it for not so good. And there are so many forces that are coming from all different directions. And I'm only talking about the United States here right now, but I feel like we're seeing this epic battle, really, that's taking shape right now in this country of where this country can go. Empires have a lifespan, right? I mean, every empire has had a start, had a peak, and then had a decline. And I'm not a fan of empires, so I don't have any problem with empires declining. But the damage they create along the way, and as they're especially on the way out, is pretty epic and big. And especially now with all the technology and all the things that we have that can do so much harm, I think there's a real fear in where we're going today. And yes, Howard, I always think, what would they be saying today? What would Howard be talking about today? And, you know, I don't think the conversation has necessarily changed. I think he would say the same thing he would be saying during the civil rights movement. He'd be saying the same thing he was saying during any kind of social change or social justice movement. But it feels like today, the people who are making the decisions can do more damage than they were able to back then, because they have such access to not only AI and other technology that's extremely destructive, or could be, but also to access to power and money. And I think that's a real challenge that we have to face today.
Yeah, real tools of destruction.
Yeah, absolutely.
When you were buying that space, it was in a building that was called Langston Lofts. And you worked the name of the restaurant chain out of that, from studying the namesake.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Langston Lofts was one of many buildings that was going up in that area that were trying to sort of align themselves with the history of that region, of that part of the city, you know. So they were naming a lot of buildings after iconic, you know, figures that had lived there and had walked those streets. And Langston Hughes was one of those individuals. Langston Hughes was the great poet of the Harlem Renaissance. So it was, I decided to name my space, because it's in the building, called the Langston Lofts, after Langston Hughes. The reason why it's called Busboys of Poets, he worked as a busboy while writing poetry. And that was the name for Busboys of Poets. And, you know, I don't think many people that were moving to those buildings had any idea of who these individuals were. So the Langston Lofts could have been, you know, the son of the owner or something like that, named Langston. They didn't know. I don't think many people who lived in that building actually knew much about Langston Hughes, other than the name of the building, it's called Langston.
Well, it's good that you remind them. And I was thinking about that because, as you said, words matter.
Words do matter, absolutely. I tell the story of, there was a building called the Ellington, named after Duke Ellington, that had a tanning salon at the base of the building, which seemed really odd to have a tanning salon in a building named after one of the most iconic composers and musicians of the 20th century, a black man, who also lived in D.C. on an area called Black Broadway, and be having a tanning salon. That was very strange.
But you note in the book, it didn't last very long.
No, it didn't last long, no. And that goes back to what we're talking about, where you just have to pull the history from the ground as opposed to, you know, parachute it to it.
Yeah, exactly. I want to thank you for your time. But before I let you go, you do say at the end of this book, to be continued. Will there be a sequel?
Well, I'm writing. I enjoy writing, so I'm always writing something. But the book was going to be about, you know, not only the opening of Busboys, but beyond, because there's been so many exciting things that have happened since we opened Busboys and Poets. But I decided that would be way too long, and it would just take way too long. So I decided to just put this out, because this is kind of like the 20th anniversary of Busboys and Poets this year. And I wanted to put something out like that, and then be able to then do a sequel that actually is what happened after I opened. All the exciting things that have happened so far. And there's been so many. I have to figure out how to put it in a way that doesn't seem like it's going every which way.
Well, I very much look forward to seeing that.
Well, thank you very much. Coming from somebody who reads a lot, I really appreciate you liking the book.
Absolutely. I do. And I recommend it to everyone who hears this podcast.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Upstart Crow. If you enjoyed today's episode, please consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Your feedback helps others find the show. Be sure to follow us on social media and check out our website at upstartcrow.org for more information on our episodes, guests, and ways you can support the podcast. You'll find all of the links in the show notes. Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you next time right here on Upstart Crow, a part of Watershed Lit Radio. Thank you.